Hey there, welcome to another episode, a long lost episode. It has been a long time coming, close to the vest. We are back, 2.0. There's been so many changes, new firm, new people, new office space. So Nikki Roos is my guest as I relaunch the podcast. And it is very special to me because Nikki was a baby lawyer with me many, many moons ago. A few firms ago. And now at SELW, Nikki has rejoined. The band is back together. Nikki, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited not only to be back working with you, but on this podcast.
I love this. And so our plan, you know, I envision us doing a bunch of episodes together. I know you are super excited to do this. And I think we have a great roster of potential new guests. So rock on.
I'm also very excited to play off our personalities as we often do in our cases. So
amen. So Nikki, why don't you, I would love for the audience just to get to know a little bit about you and your background. You know, go all the way back to, you know, you graduated from Penn Law School, and then you have an awesome perspective as a practitioner now from your past experiences. And when you came to work with me years ago, you had clerked for a matrimonial judge.
Correct. So I feel very lucky and grateful that I've had a little bit of taste of everything. So to your point, I finished law school at Penn, and I actually thought that I was going to be a corporate transactional attorney. And that's what I did as my first job. I clerked at a very large law firm in New York City, and I found the work to be very intellectually stimulating. But if you won or lost a point on a deal, or you were doing due diligence, you were really dealing with a team of lawyers. So again, while it was very intellectually stimulating, it wasn't as emotionally fulfilling for me. So I went the complete opposite way and serendipitously fell into the practice of family law, which is, I think, the furthest you could get. You go from, you know, corporate transactional work to very personal litigation.
So true.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to have the experience of being able to clerk for a matrimonial judge who at the time was about to retire off the bench. So she had a huge number of cases that she was trying to resolve, dealing with a lot of different issues. And I got this clerkship because I took a very interesting class in law school and found the subject matter to be interesting and then had an introduction to this judge. So my first taste as an extremely young lawyer, I was so privileged to sit behind the bench and get to kind of see what's the process. How does a judge think about things? What are the different issues that they're looking at? And more importantly, how do they set aside their own feelings from the law and the facts of the case? And I have to say, as a baby lawyer, you're probably never going to get more respect in your life, especially straight out of school. So, you know, not only was that a wonderful position, but I think one of the biggest things that I learned based on, you know, all of the good things that I saw many of the attorneys do was also a lot of things not to do, which was just as valuable. As soon as I finished that experience, I came to work with you. So again, having experienced what a judge is looking for and having seen the perspective of what the arguments look like from a lawyer on the bench, it was great to be able to then actually practice. And as a baby lawyer at a more boutique firm, I really had a lot of hands-on experience. So I remember you were sending me to court, you know, very early on to argue my own motions. I was, you know, taking witness testimony at certain things. And as a young lawyer, it was very intimidating, but probably some of the best experience that I've ever had.
I love that. And what, so then you left us and you went to go work for a bigger law firm. And what did you, you know, without getting into too much details on that, what did you see as more so as a matrimonial practitioner? Because, you know, for the audience, most family law attorneys are boutique. You know, they're a lot of solo practitioners or boutique law firms. You don't often find a divorce attorney in a big firm. So can you just speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So, I mean, not that it's so interesting to the listeners, but the reason why most divorce lawyers work at boutique or smaller firms is because that's what the practice lends itself to. You know, bigger firms are not such a hospitable environment for this just because the costs are too high. And also oftentimes you're servicing clients that other attorneys at these huge firms are also dealing with. So you get conflicted out. But, you know, one of the things that I was really looking for at the time that I left your firm initially was to get exposure to a broader variety of practice styles. So at a bigger firm, there's 20 to 30 partners within a group, and everybody has their own different personality and they have different strengths and weaknesses. So as a young lawyer, to be able to see that, gain the experience, see what worked for people and didn't, and adopt that to my own style was invaluable. And then the caliber of the cases. Again, I was extremely lucky because when you're working at a larger firm, you know, unfortunately, you can really only service a segment of the population because of how cost prohibitive it is. But then the assets that you're fighting over aren't, you know, the couch or the dog. You're fighting over these really interesting assets. You know, you're fighting over these huge businesses, big properties. They're worth a lot of money. But setting that aside, every client is in a different industry. So getting the breadth of dealing with someone in private equity or dealing with someone in the fashion industry or dealing with a high profile, you know, famous person. So not only are you dealing with the law, but you're starting to learn about the very specific issues and concerns that each of your clients have. And that's, I think, exposure that I would not have been able to get in a different environment. And then just understanding the expectations of the clients. You know, you have to have quick responsiveness. You have to handle things no matter what. You really have to be a problem solver and not just a lawyer, because you're helping them with their finances and their, you know, how they're moving forward, but also their children and their families. So you're half an attorney, half a lawyer, half a concierge service, but really understanding how to service someone's needs holistically was also a great lesson that I was able to learn.
Sure. So going back, you mentioned something when you were clerking for the judge right out of school. You mentioned you learned what practitioners should do and not do. Like, people always want to hear what a judge wants, and just take us behind the curtain a little bit. And some answers may be really just pure common sense, but you'd be surprised, or a lot of people would be surprised, on how unprepared lawyers, forget litigants, and how they behave during a divorce. But can you just shed some light on what judges expect from lawyers and what you saw?
Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest things that I really learned was your reputation and your integrity is key. So your role as the lawyer is to advocate as strongly as possible for your client. But at the same time, you're appearing in front of the same judges and you're having the same adversaries on different cases. So oftentimes we would see a lawyer coming in, arguing one side of an argument on one case, coming in on another case and taking a completely different position. And obviously you can't avoid that sometimes, but it's hard to take an attorney seriously when you're not being honest about, okay, you know, Your Honor, this is my client's position. I understand that, you know, there may be some unreasonableness to that, or there may be things that I need to talk to my client about. But not being able to separate your ability to advocate versus your integrity and maintaining, you know, a judge knows when you're making a representation, or a judge knows that you're making an argument, that it's genuine because they've seen you take consistent positions throughout, was a really, really big one. And again, you're adjusting for each case and each fact pattern, but just your integrity and your honesty with the court and your ability to acknowledge the strengths and weaknesses of your case was, I think, something that seems really basic, but a lot of people were not able to really do.
Yeah, well, listen, I think we're advocates. At the end of the day, we're hired guns. We need to counsel our clients. But I also think there needs to be some sort of deference by the judge, the fact finder, to understand that it's inevitable as practitioners that we are going to argue maybe the other side. And to me, that's why maybe there's a value certainly when a lot of judges will take you into chambers before you have to go on the record. And then you can be a little bit more, you know, open and honest about your position, understanding maybe the flaws, and then allow the litigants to be heard in open court with a stenographer. Not only will a lawyer be more candid and open, but I think it also allows the judge to be open and honest than they would otherwise be if the stenographer's rolling.
Correct. And you know, the other thing that you have to think about too is judges will look at the facts and apply the law and have certain parameters of how they can make decisions, but they're also oftentimes trying to help you settle. And they can come up with creative ways after hearing from your clients, you know, what's really important? Why are you really fighting for this, right? Is it the dollars? Is it the control? Is it, you know, a piece of anger or emotion that you're holding on to? But it's important for a judge to understand and listen to your client because they can come up with creative solutions when they're trying to help you settle as well.
I totally agree. And, you know, we talk about, you know, we've all had that client who gets upset. How come you're going in the back? There are certain judges, a client will never have seen them, have never have spoken to them throughout the case because the lawyers are always going into the robing room and meeting with the judge. And there's a tremendous value to that. But then there are clients, they just want to feel heard. And how do you juggle and deal with that balancing act where a client doesn't feel like, even though you may be, you know, fighting aggressively for that client, how do you manage your client's expectations in that situation?
So I think, first of all, a client needs to understand that not everything is dictated by the attorneys or the parties. Obviously, the court is there to try to help and serve you to resolve whatever is going on. But I really think the most important thing and something that I focus on in all my relationships is a very strong trust between the attorney and their client. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to parrot your client's position or that you're going to agree with your client 100% of the time about what they really feel or think about. But if there is not a fundamental trust about, you know, what you're representing to your client has been said or what you're advocating about behind the scenes, that's a really big issue for me. And that might be a little bit different than what you're asking me about. But again, I think when people are looking for their attorney and they're going into these cases, there's a lot of really well-qualified attorneys, but feeling really comfortable with someone and having that resonate, that relationship is going to be so valuable because you're already going through a really emotionally vulnerable time. You're going to be having a lot of ups and downs. And I think the joke that a lot of attorneys make is, you know, the difference between a criminal attorney and a divorce attorney is that when you're dealing with criminal attorney, your clients are probably bad people on their best behavior. When you're a divorce attorney, you're dealing generally with good people who are maybe not on their best behavior or not in their top form.
So true.
So having that trust to begin with and maintaining it throughout the relationship goes, I think, a very long way, especially when the client is not going to be able to see everything and they're going to have to rely on you, that you understand the position and you're fighting very hard for them.
So it's so true. So you're a mom. So I'm going to bounce around here. There's a lot of topics to cover in a short period of time. You know, I remember as when I was a young lawyer practicing family law, I heard this line, well, do you have kids? You know, well, if you don't have kids, you don't understand this. And maybe that was a lawyer on the other side talking down to me but I generally now, having practiced for 26 years, being a lot older, as a family law attorney, I definitely think personal experiences help doing what we do. And so how, if anything, has your practicing changed having become a mom?
So I think it's exactly to your point. The funny thing is, I think the biggest change to my practice was when I got married myself. The level of rage that you feel in an argument with a husband or wife, is very different than one with just a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Right. So I understand a lot more now, and I can relate to what my clients are saying about stupid things that before, you know, I couldn't really empathize with them, but now I do. But more importantly, on the issue of the children, you know, I always try to think about a case in terms of what's best for a child, even when I was much younger and I didn't have kids. But now it's much easier for me to understand, you know, if a client is coming to me saying, I need the pickup or the drop off to be on a Sunday night versus a Monday morning, to an outside observer with no children, it doesn't really make a difference. But right. to a parent who's trying to get a kid ready for school and knows that their kid needs to be settled, or knows that their kid is flexible enough and they can just go straight to school, it's just a lot of, as you said, having actually lived these things myself. It's not that I advocate less or differently, but I understand the import of these things, having experienced them myself now firsthand. Many of the joys.
No, it's so true. And like, having gone through a divorce, I am so able to relate how much more anxiety I would have if I had to do a transition at 7 o'clock on a Sunday versus dropping off, one of my boys at school Monday morning. You know, you're coming back from the Hamptons and there's traffic on the LIE and you keep looking at that, you know, clock on the dashboard. Am I going to make it to the drop off? What's going to happen? Do I have to send the email now? Do I have to make the phone call now? And, you know, to be able to walk in their shoes, so to speak, I think is really helpful, especially when they call you frantic on Sunday night, notwithstanding the fact that there's not much you're going to be able to do. So it's really, I think that's certainly valuable. So as a mom, you're a family law attorney, do you take the stuff home with you?
I think, you know, for a period of time, I actually really struggled with how much it weighed on me and I didn't recognize it. So I've worked really hard now to kind of, I never really turn it off. I actually think about my cases all the time. And a lot of times, like, creative solutions or ideas that I come up with are just, you know, if I'm doing something else or I'm thinking about something. But I found that it's really important to not necessarily separate, but really appreciate the situation that I have and understand it puts a lot of things into perspective for me. And I think I learn as much from my clients as they do from me. So it is extremely important for me to understand, you know, if I'm fighting with my husband because we don't agree about the schedule about how to feed the bottles, it's really not relevant at the end of the day, right? So I actually think I bring it home, but it helps me to appreciate putting things in perspective more and also saying thank you and sorry a lot more.
I love that. That's awesome. Have you found that it's made you more jaded in the relationship? Because, you know, I think a lot of people can go the complete opposite. And for your first reaction was to say, well, I can acknowledge my fault. And we tend to see a lot of relationships, you know, the demise because people are unable to do that.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest issue a lot of people have, whether it comes to parenting or marriage or anything, is it's a lack of insight into your own culpability, because it's really hard to acknowledge your faults. And when you're in an emotionally charged situation and, you know, this is the item on the table right now that my other person is doing that's really upsetting me, it's hard to kind of step back. And I think I see that that is one of the biggest issues that people have that they can't overcome. You forget that you're supposed to be, whether you're in an intact marriage or you're divorced and you're trying to co-parent these kids together, the ultimate goal, you should have an ultimate goal of trying to make things better for everybody.
Sure.
Right? That might look different for everybody, but, you know, the goal is what's the best for the kids, set aside my issues. What's the best for this dynamic between us that can be seamless even if we're not still together in a romantic capacity? And I think people lose sight about that, because they're human and they're hurt, they're upset, they've been through all of these experiences, they're trying to process their own anger about things, and it can get, you know, very difficult for people.
It's really it is a very difficult time. So I want to bounce around again. You recently were certified as an attorney for the children. Just for people that may not know what that means, can you just elaborate?
Sure. So there is a unique role in cases where people are going through a divorce and they have custody issues, and it's a very heated custody issue, and their children are of an age that they are old enough to articulate at least some, you know, position of where they are. The courts will often appoint an attorney for the child who is there solely to advocate for the child. You know, children have, I think, a really difficult role in divorces because they have no control over the situation, and they are impacted just as much, if not more so, than the parties because they didn't really have a role in this decision. So it's really important to be able to give a voice to a child. And again, you know, parents hopefully oftentimes are focusing on what's best for their children, but they're also going through a very tumultuous time. And it's difficult to separate their own needs and interests from that of the child. So having an attorney for the child who's really solely there to listen, to advocate, to try to make the situation better for the child is, I think, a very valuable role, and one that, again, not everybody will need, and hopefully you will not need in your case because you're able to come to some sort of agreement about custody. But when things are heated and it's very difficult, it's a good way to give a voice to a person who is, you know, going through a process without any ability to have control over the situation.
Sure. And so we hear about AFCs, and then we also hear another concept, guardian ad litem. What's that?
So there's a difference between the two in the sense that attorney for the child is advocating for this child, and unless there is, you know, really evidence of severe, you know, lack of judgment on the child's part, where an attorney for the child would substitute their own judgment, your role as the attorney for the child is to advocate purely for their position. You can also have guardians in situations where there may be some diminished capacity, there may be some issues, whether it's a mental health issue, whether it's, you know, an individual that may not, you know, after looking at the factors of the case, may not really have the capacity to understand and appreciate their own role. So guardians are taking a much more active role to substitute their own judgment more and to try to get resources in place, whatever that looks like for their client or for their ward, actually. So it's a little bit different.
I'm going to ask you some questions about substituted judgment in a second.
Sure.
But before we get there, I love that you did this. And I think I've wanted to do this for a while. I've had the application for a long time. But just have never finished it. What was your motivation behind becoming an attorney for the child?
So, you know, I think having practiced for quite a while now, I really got to sink my teeth into a lot of different areas. So I did a lot of really complicated, heavy financial cases. You know, I did a lot of other cases that were resolved in mediation or arbitration, alternative dispute resolution. And an area that had always been an interest to me, and particularly after I had my own children, was how are children protected in this process? Because again, they are often along for the ride. So it really stemmed from a combination of now having my own children and seeing, you know, really what it's like to be a parent. And then second of all, having been involved in so many nasty custody cases where I was fortunate enough to be able to help people through a difficult situation to get to a better place in terms of parenting. But the next step for me naturally was, well, how do I really work with children more? How do I advocate for them? Because again, they don't really have a voice in this space. There's not that many AFCs, and a lot of them are so overburdened and, or, you know, they're a little bit older. They're about ready to retire. So not only did I see that there was an actual need for the service, but it just aligned naturally with the fact that I became a parent and had been involved in so many more of these really ugly custody cases with quite tragic outcomes sometimes. So it was a culmination of all these factors.
And for those people who have not yet, let's say, pulled the trigger and they're just curious, explain, if you could just explain, like, what happens if an attorney, if you get appointed, what do you do?
So my role typically is I would like to speak and hear from both of the parents to understand what their concerns are, what they view their child as, what issues they think are there. But really, the most important step to me is to meet with my client and speak to them about how they're feeling, what's going on, and most importantly, what I can do to help them in their situation. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to align with what the parents think are best. And it also doesn't necessarily mean that it aligns with what a judge will ultimately determine.
Sure.
But again, being able to give a voice to that child. And, you know, it's not necessarily substituting judgment, but a lot of these children are not even aware of different resources and positions that they have. So acting as a safe space for them and encouraging them to do things that you think might be in their best interest. For example, I think it would be great if you started therapy, you know, or I've had cases where children are really torn about being stuck between mom or dad, or mom and mom, or dad and dad. And they're really worried about hurting people's feelings overly, you know, to the detriment of their own situation, right? Because children have their own needs. They're developing. They need to learn how to develop their own emotional resilience and how to develop boundaries. So oftentimes I can even be the scapegoat. You know, my client will say to me, I really don't want to be with mom, or I really don't want to be with dad, but I don't want to be in a position where they understand that. I can work with them to come up with plans. Like, how can we come up with a way to help better your relationship? Or how can we frame this in a way that it's not going to upset one of the parents so that it upsets the overall settlement discussions? So you have, I think, a lot of hats as an AFC, but your main goal really is to protect your client, advocate for their position, and help them kind of really understand and develop that sometimes, because a lot of times they're young and they are also learning and going through this process.
And are there scenarios where you, let's say, your client, the child, has articulated what he or she wants, but maybe the reason behind it is misplaced, or let's say flawed, for lack of a better word?
Sure, that happens frequently. Again, you know, children know how they feel and they know what they want, but sometimes they don't always understand that. And again, you know, I've had cases where, hey, I really want to be with dad all the time. And when you scratch a little deeper, it's because dad has zero rules, lets you play whatever video games you want, and, you know, you can eat junk food and you don't have to do your homework. Which, of course, the child is going to really enjoy, but is it really necessarily the best thing for them? Not necessarily. So am I still going to advocate? You know, my client has a really strong relationship and wants to spend time with dad. Of course, but I have to be careful in terms of balancing. You know, I need to maintain trust with my client and advocate for them. But there is a way to articulate, you know, my client likes X. Here are the reasons why. Right, after speaking to my client about what I can and cannot share, and then letting the attorneys and the judge kind of understand what's going on behind the scenes. Because, you know, parents often substitute their judgment for their children, as they should, right? And a court can as well. But my role also is to provide as much information to everybody as possible to try to make the situation better.
So as lawyers representing the parties, we're often found jockeying for our client's position with the AFC. You used to be in that position, you still are, and now you're wearing the hat as an attorney for the child. What is that like now, having seen, you know, before we talked about being behind the curtain in the position of, you know, the judge's role, now you're sitting there representing the child, being jockeyed by somebody else?
So one thing that is really interesting that I really never appreciated while I was representing only the parents is that there can be a lot more going on in the conversations between the child and their lawyer than you're privy to, on purpose and by design. So I think oftentimes as an attorney for the parents, I would say, you know, the AFC is not strong enough. They're not taking enough action. I don't know why they're not doing X, Y, Z. But the reality is there could be a lot of conversations and considerations that are going on behind the scenes that you're not going to be able to know about because the attorney for the child cannot speak. So it actually is quite an awesome responsibility because, again, your client is much younger. They don't have the experience of having a, from a physiological standpoint, a fully developed brain that is able to understand, process emotions. But on top of that, you know, again, you have to be very sensitive to children. Some of them are very open and happy to speak to you. Some of them are really guarded and they don't want to talk about things. A lot of them are going through trauma of their parents separating. So one thing I really didn't appreciate, which I hope attorneys are able to understand, is AFC's roles, they're very happy to hear from the parents and to understand things and get facts because that helps to inform the picture. But there can oftentimes be a lot more happening than you're aware of. And AFC's hands are often tied for good and bad reason, depending on the circumstance.
I completely appreciate that. What I find often, especially with AFCs that are overworked, is that they're not articulating exactly what you just said. They're just saying, here's what my client said. You often will hear from them a day before the court appearance, or very often a few minutes before the court appearance in the hallway, or before the Zoom, depending on if it's virtual or in person. And then that becomes another bag of frustration because your client wants to know, where are we? Where do we stand? Sometimes the lawyer is making a representation based on a meeting they had with their client that was probably 3 months ago, and they never have had an updated, they have not had an updated meeting with their client since, and things have changed in the last 3 months. How do you deal with that?
So I definitely don't want to speak for every AFC. I know that unfortunately the system is extremely overburdened, much like, you know, judges are overburdened. Many attorneys are as well. And I think as anyone who's been through this process can attest, it's certainly not perfect. I would say that for myself, having taken on this role, part of this role is that you also have to do a little bit of public service and that you sit on something called an 18B panel. So in order to take on the role of the attorney for the child, you must also help with indigent clients who are dealing with custody issues and are coming in through court. So those are, I think, what people commonly think of as legal aid attorneys. And I have to say, it is, the volume is overwhelming at times. And again, I don't want to speak for my all of my brethren, but I will say for myself, it's really important for me to actually spend time talking to my client, to do it as in advance as possible, but also frequently as possible, and also being mindful of what's going on in their life, what court dates are coming up. So I think in the same way that there's a variable quality of judges or lawyers, there is a variable quality of the attorney for the children. And some of it is a function of, unfortunately, some of them are just really busy. But I have managed in my own way to come up with a case management system to ensure that contact is regular, it's frequent, and I know my clients well enough to know what the events are and what the important things are to the parents as well, so that I'm meeting with them regularly enough to know what's going on and really have a meaningful impact to report to the parents and to the court.
We often hear this fact pattern. The child articulates something. We hear it from the AFC. It's clear that those words were not, did not come from, let's say, a seven-year-old. How do you sift through that, where clearly one parent, or maybe both parents for that matter, are discussing things with the child during the divorce?
So I think that actually just comes with experience. And again, the experience of having my own children and kind of knowing what the general milestones are, but also the experience of, like I said, I think it's important to speak to the parties so you understand their position, you have a little bit of tone. And I think after you've been doing this for a while, it's pretty easy to discern, you know, this is how my client really feels. This is what mom and dad are telling them. And the thing that I think is harder for a lot of people is that they don't understand that if they're speaking about things around or in front of their children, the children will often adopt that too, which can be just as harmful as mom deliberately saying, say this to the lawyer, right?
Yeah, you're right.
So a lot of it is experience and emotional intelligence. And again, becoming familiar enough with your client to really be able to discern between what you think is genuine and what some of it is very obvious that's being parroted from a parent, but some of it is not so. So it's just experience.
And so you talked about what to do and not do as a practitioner in front of the judge. What now, having done this, having been an AFC for a bit of time, what do you believe lawyers should be doing or not doing when communicating with the attorney for the children?
So I think the most important thing is I always enjoy seeing a lawyer advocate strongly for their client, but I also equally and maybe even more so enjoy when an attorney is hearing my feedback that is coming from a client. So again, without really going into too much details or revealing what's happening, I've had a few cases where, you know, genuinely both parents want to have a better relationship with a child, but because the child is in between and torn and doesn't really know what to say, they've been able to articulate to me as a neutral safe space, this is what, you know, mom does that bothers me. This is what dad does that bothers me. This is what I would love to happen in our relationship. And the cases that I find that are the best are when I'm able to have candid conversations with attorneys about their clients and what they can do and what responsibility they have as to why the dynamic is the way it is. So being open to feedback and understanding that you have culpability, but you also have the ability to work on things to better the situation, I think is so valuable and rare.
Sure.
Very rare. A lot of people just want to litigate, or they just try to point the finger at, you know, dad is alienating me from the child, or mom is keeping me from the kids, and they don't look at what is within their own power to change.
It makes sense. Sometimes it's hard and challenging as a lawyer representing that party, or a party that's fixated on a particular issue. Is there any other advice that you would give, not to the lawyers, but to the individual parties that are going through a custody battle?
I think one thing that I tell to people very frequently, and this has nothing to do with me being a lawyer, is you really have to hold on to the concept of you really must love your children more than you hate your ex. And that's a very difficult concept sometimes. And it seems very common sense. But if you can remember, it doesn't matter what, you know, your ex-husband or your ex-wife did. And of course, you're going to have feelings about that. And it's going to affect your relationship. But put that aside and look at the bigger goal of, I just need to do what's best for my kids. If my ex is not going to be able to do this, I've got to step up and overcompensate. Or if I know that this is how they've always been as a parent, why are you going to try to fight the battle to change them? You know, try to do what's within your control. And again, just love your kids more than you hate your ex. It's simple, but it's such an important and great way if you can actually manage it to kind of get through this very difficult process.
And nowadays, we see the use of parenting coordinators more and more. And we can have several podcast episodes just on that topic alone.
Absolutely.
What is your feeling about the use of parenting coordinators?
I think that they can be extremely effective in the right situation and if you're picking the right person for your case. And I see them as valuable in two ways. In cases where parents really generally agree about things, it's just a wonderful resource because, God forbid, every once in a while you do disagree about something, it's great to have a parenting coordinator in place already that is familiar with your circumstances that can help you with discrete issues. And for people who are in really highly conflicted situations, a parenting coordinator can be key because, unfortunately, some people really can't even agree about the color of the sky. So this person is going to help, hopefully, you know, get through those log jams, avoid having to run to court every time you have an issue. But more importantly, and for parties who are open to it, a lot of times they can help almost as like a parenting coaching resource to say, hey, they're going to see both of your personalities as a third person. They're going to see what's important to each of you. They may be able to help you navigate this difficult dynamic. So again, if you have a really good one and both people are invested in the process, it can be very valuable.
And in similar vein, you know, we have seen parties reach a negotiated settlement, and sometimes that AFC will be called upon to act as a parenting coordinator. What's your feeling about that?
Again, I think it depends on the situation and the circumstances. If there are cases where, first of all, there may not be an actual conflict, but I think it's very important for the children or the child to understand, you know, my parents have worked with this person through the case. They were representing me before. They understand my position. They found it to be effective. They would like to still continue to be involved in the process. It can be very helpful where everybody is on board and feels comfortable with it. But other times, you know, again, people don't always act true to themselves or in their, you know, best light when they're going through these divorce processes. And they'd like to start fresh with somebody who, you know, wasn't privy to the nasty dynamic.
Sure.
And they want to just have a fresh start and hopefully have a better relationship going forward. So it really depends on the situation and the people.
And we often see a situation where the parties may be litigating, and next thing you know, the judge asks the AFC to serve as a mediator. Can you just speak to that?
You know, again, the AFC's role really is to represent the children. But if what we're dealing with is a custody dispute, and the highest prerogative and goal here is to really focus on the children's best interests, I actually think that a very effective AFC that has buy-in from both parents and attorneys can be a very effective mediator. So again, another case, not too many details. I have been helping these parties who have actually an incredibly acrimonious divorce reach. We're very close now to getting to a settlement on custody. And I think the unique ability that I had to remind them that, you know, their child is the most important and they need to set aside their feelings. And I am theoretically not neutral. I represent their child, but that's what they're really trying to focus on, was a really effective means to get to a resolution or a negotiated resolution. But again, it depends on the dynamics between the parties, their counsel, and, you know, the AFC and their personality as well.
And how, for the audience, just explain how you come to be, how do you get appointed?
So appointments happen two ways. Mostly they come through a judge who knows that they need an AFC. If they're familiar with you, they've seen your work before, they feel confident and happy with their work, they'll appoint you. Other times, attorneys who have worked with AFCs may mutually agree and ask a judge to appoint a particular person. Again, there are so many different AFCs with different personalities. Everybody's client is different. Every dynamic is different.
Sure. So I get asked a lot, what should I look for in a matrimonial lawyer? And I think if you lined up 10 lawyers, they'd give you 25 answers. So to what's your perspective on that?
My perspective is perhaps I don't have 25 different answers, but you know, I think at a very bare minimum, you want someone who is qualified with a lot of experience handling this type of law, because it is very specific and it's different than other areas. So you want someone who is at a bare minimum qualified and very experienced. And I think beyond that, what you really need to look for is someone that you feel comfortable with. Because again, you're going through a battle where you're fighting over your livelihood, your home, your children. So you need someone who's going to understand and align with your position. But that doesn't necessarily mean someone who's always going to just tell you what you want to hear.
Sure.
So I would look for someone that you, beyond, you know, the qualifications and the experience, I would look for someone that you resonate with personally, that you can connect with. because I think that's extremely important. This is the partner that you're going to be walking through one of the hardest things in your life with. So, and there's many lawyers and there are many different people. And I think the one universal piece of advice that I would say, though, is there's this conception that everybody wants a shark, right? They want the most aggressive right. lawyer that can get there because they really want to just screw over their ex or, you know, annihilate them because in this moment of anger, this is what they are looking for. And I would say you should find a lawyer who's extremely strong and who can advocate and who is not scared to litigate, but that should not be their first instinct because oftentimes all of your money will be going to your lawyers instead of your kids and your family. And also, it's not necessarily the best outcome of your case to demolish the other side, right? You're still going to have to parent with this other person. And more importantly, the anger and resentment or whatever you're feeling is really only going to harm you, right? You want someone who's going to get you out of the situation as quickly and with the best result as possible. And that oftentimes doesn't mean trying to annihilate the other person. You just need someone who has that ability and isn't scared, but that's not going to be their first instinct.
So true. I can't tell you how many times people say, you know, are you a bully? Are you a bulldog? And, you know, blind aggression is not a great strategy.
I mean, there are lawyers out there who will say, okay, pay me $200,000 instead of your ex. Right. They'll do it. And, you know, if that's really your prerogative, I guess that's your prerogative. Sure. But you also have to think about the bigger picture. And at the end of the day, what do you want for your life and your family and your relationship with this person that you're still going to raise children with?
Amen. So how do you, at the end of the day, how do you self-care?
That is actually probably the hardest question that you've asked me. But I think for a long time, I really neglected that side of my life and it caught up to me. You know, burnout is very real. Everybody survived COVID barely, right. especially us parents with young children. But now I think it's just important for me to carve out time for my own interests and take care of myself. If it's something as simple as, you know, I'm going to go every half hour in the morning for a run. I'm going to make sure that I book time to see my friends. I'm going to make sure that I have a nanny so that on a weekend I can take a few hours to do whatever it is that I want to do for myself. Because the happier I am, the better parent I am, the better turn I am, the better partner I am for my spouse. But I think a lot of people lose sight of that. And they just think about, well, I have all this work to do. I've got all this, you know, that can go by the wayside. But it really does catch up with you.
So true. Yeah. 50 pounds later, I definitely understand that.
Foodie as well.
And you're happily married. Where this is a relationship podcast. What makes your marriage work?
I think the most important things are just a baseline of respect and good communication. So my husband and I are extremely different in many ways, and we don't agree on a lot of different things, but I think we share a lot of the same core values, and it's okay for us to agree to disagree.
Someone I know said this, and they were, they quoted Kevin Bacon. It's not about whether you fight or not, but it's more you fight and how you make up and how you work through your differences. So I think that's really profound.
It's true. I think there's a lot of literature and research, actually. It's not how often you fight. It's how quickly and the quality of your repair. So if you're fighting 20 different times a day, but you're happy at the end of it, that could actually be a healthier relationship than people who don't fight at all because they're not talking. So it is a good point.
So I just want to say thank you so much for doing this. It's been a really long time since I did this, and I apologize to you and to the audience. I'm a bit rusty, but I wouldn't want to do this with any other person. I am so glad you joined the team. I am happy and proud to call you my law partner, and I look forward to many more of these together with some great guests. I have one last question before we go.
All right.
And I ask every guest, I'm a bit of a, as you know, a sneaker snob. So what's your favorite sneaker?
So mine may be a little different, but I am a runner. And 20 different shoes later, while trying to train for a marathon, I have now found that OnCloud shoes, the new version, are the good ones. So that's my favorite sneaker at the moment.
Okay, then. Awesome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.